Bury it in the churchyard quickly.
That was the old man's instructions to you as he pressed a stoneware jug into your hands. It's heavy, much heavier than you expected, and you can hear a tinkle of metal inside. As you pull open the door, a bit of liquid splashes out of the jug and onto your hands. It smells of ammonia and sulfur, a sharp acritic smell that lets you know you'll need to wash your hands as soon as possible once you've finished your task. As you run through the wet, muddy streets of York, up Old Pony Street, you worry that you'll be stopped at any moment. The witch or magician or sorcerer or whatever they call themselves could be lurking around any corner, ready to cast their evil eye upon you. You make it to the churchyard and take a second to catch your breath just inside the gates. Witches, you know, avoid holy ground. Simply being on consecrated soil may be enough to break the curse haunting the old man's house. But just in case, you dash across the graveyard, clawing at the ground to make a small hole. Gently, you lower the jug into the hole, hurriedly covering it over again with the earth. You've just buried the Judge's Lodging witch bottle. In Viking times, a thing was a gathering, a place where leaders and warriors could meet and talk. In the 21st century, our thing is a virtual place where history academics and enthusiasts from around the world can come together to share knowledge. I'm your host, Miranda Schmiederer. Hold on to your helmets for this episode of that Jorvik Viking Thing podcast. We're continuing our ominous October series covering all things creepy and spooky. Last time, we talked about Roman ghosts here in York and even the disappearance of the Ninth Legion. This time, we're moving forward to the medieval period, talking about magic and some of the people who practiced it here in Yorkshire. You may be wondering about the Judge's Lodging witch bottle from the top of the episode. During the 16th through 19th centuries, witches' bottles were a fairly common object used to protect people from harmful spells. The early modern belief in magic was just as strong as the medieval one, and most people just understood magic as an everyday force in their lives. Because of this, people would take protection against magic very seriously. To make a witch bottle, a person would fill a regular everyday jug or bottle with nails and pins, urine, human or animal hair, and sometimes animal bones or a piece of textile. The nails, pins, and urine were there to repel magical energy, and the hair, bones, or textiles were used to personalize the protection. Either the hair of the suspected witch or sorcerer was placed in the bottle to ward specifically against them, or hair from a member of the household could be put in the bottle to give it an extra level of protection. The Judge's Lodging witch bottle was filled with copper alloy pins and some pieces of textile, and it seems that there was urine in there as well, but that has since evaporated. The bottle was found intact, and in order to see what was inside, x-rays were taken. Archaeologists from the York Archaeological Trust were able to see that pins had gathered up near the neck of the bottle, but weren't sure about the rest of it. Objects like hair, textiles, and other organic materials don't show up on x-rays, and in order to see into the bottle itself, they'd have to remove the pins, which would damage them, or damage the bottle. So for now, what precisely was in the bottle will remain a mystery. Witch bottles are often found in inaccessible places or inside of a home. Graveyards, for example, were a popular place to bury them, as it was believed that witches, sorcerers, or other evil magic practitioners were unable to enter hallowed ground. Likewise, people thought that some magical people couldn't cross running water, so the bottle could be buried near rivers. Several witch bottles have been found along the River Thames waterfront. Inside the home, witch bottles could be placed inside walls, underneath hearths, and even under a doorstep, weaving protection into the home itself. Approximately 200 witch bottles have been found across the UK, but because of where they're often buried, it's very possible that there are still hundreds more waiting to be found. The Judge's Lodging witch bottle was found at the rear of modern-day Judge's Lodgings here in York, a Grade 1 listed building which is now a hospitality venue, where a garden has been since the 18th century. Before that, it's thought that it was possibly a graveyard connected to St. Leonard's Hospital, which is right across the street today. The Judge's Lodging witch bottle is currently on display at Barley Hall as part of our Magic and Mystery exhibition. I was lucky enough to chat with Sky McKenna, who helped to create this exhibition, all about magic in the medieval world. Here's my conversation with her. So can you go ahead and introduce yourself for our listeners?
My name's Skye McKenna. I'm a researcher at the York Archaeological Trust, and I helped to curate Magic and Mystery, an exhibition at Barley Hall in York, which gave me a wonderful opportunity to do some further research into the history of medieval magic, which has been an interest of mine for a very long time now.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, we are going to be talking to you about medieval magic and magicians and sorcerers and all kinds of fun stuff. But let's start with the basics. When we say magic, what does that even mean to a medieval person?
Yeah, so basically it's as difficult to define then as it is now. If you ask someone today to define magic, they'll think they have an idea of what that is. And as soon as they start to describe it, they'll realize actually it means different things in different contexts. It might mean a different thing to one person who has really strong religious views. It might have a different meaning to someone else who is more of a sort of scientific background. It's much the same in the Middle Ages. Different people had different thoughts about what that meant. But for the clergy in particular, it was really important to have a clear idea of what was and wasn't magic, because it was their responsibility to basically prohibit it and to make sure that their parishioners weren't practicing magic. So they needed to kind of put this down in writing and figure out, you know, what was like legitimate and licit practice and religious practice and what was actually counted as magic. And one of the most influential definitions that we have in writing is from William of Auvergne, who was a bishop of Paris in the 13th century. And he did a lot of reading. He actually read a lot of magical texts himself. And he came up with the definition that magic is marvels that are produced by one of three things. And it's either by the help of demons, by sleight of hand or deception. So kind of what we might think of now as kind of illusionism and sort of magic tricks, or by something called natural magic, which we probably don't have as clear an idea of, I think. And I think it's really interesting that he broke it down into these three things, because to start off with, it really highlights the importance of where the source of this magical power comes from. That's sort of the most important thing to clarify. It's less important sort of what you're doing or who you are, and it's more important, you know, are you sort of doing these magical marvels via the help of demons? That's what we want to avoid, clearly. Or are they just tricks? Because medieval people were skeptical as well, particularly sort of earlier in the period, you know, when you have a sort of influx of different scientific texts and there's a sort of an intellectual revival, there's a lot of people that are basically saying that magic isn't real. So there's that skepticism there as well, which is really interesting. And that's where you might have people say, well, it's all delusions that are produced either by, you know, tricks of the magicians or by demons basically causing you to hallucinate and things like this. And then natural magic is, to me, kind of the most interesting thing, because it's where we tie in medieval magic with early ideas about science and experimentation. And natural magic is the idea that natural substances, so that could be stones or plants or animals or even the stars and the planets, have what they called occult virtues or occult properties. And these were sort of things that they were powers that these things had, but we didn't understand why they had them. But it wasn't because demons were necessarily involved. It was perhaps because the powers were just hidden. And that's what the word occult means in Latin. It just means hidden. And so that was one good way of explaining why, say, certain herbs might be tied to your arm to cure something, or why a certain stone might make you more eloquent if you carried it or wore it on a ring, or why even the influences of the stars through astrology might affect sort of people's behavior and their circumstances could be all sort of explained through this natural magic. So yeah, his definition was really influential, and it was something that was argued against as well as adopted widely by people who were sort of saying, you know, what I'm doing is natural magic and therefore it's licit. So it kind of gave an excuse as well, but there were also plenty of clergymen who sort of fought back against it and said, no, all magic is caused by demons. So it's a real mix of different views and opinions. I think what's really hard to get at is the views of sort of ordinary everyday people, because they usually weren't writing about magic. Their views might not have been reflected in the writings of the clergy. And so we have a less clear idea of what their idea of magic was and what they thought was licit and illicit as well. But we do know that there was a lot of magic going on, and the magic that they were using, the sort of common everyday magic, was really for the same sort of things that people have been using magic for throughout history. So things like curing illness, predicting the future, trying to find out what's going to happen to you, and also specifically finding lost or stolen items was a really common use of magic throughout history, but particularly in the medieval and early modern periods. So that's where we can get a bit of information. We can kind of figure out what medieval people were using the magic for, and then we can get a clear idea of what sort of educated clergy thought about magic and how they defined it as well.
So I suppose that kind of leads into my next question. So then what kind of sources do you look at for information about medieval magic or witches or sorcerers?
Yes, so some of the best sources we have are church records, from church courts in particular. So, you know, if you're accused of practicing magic at the time, it wasn't something that was likely to be dealt with in a civil court. It was likely to be dealt with in a church court because it was sort of to do with belief and practice and heresy and those sorts of things. We also have pastoral manuals, which were written by sort of higher up clergy to teach clerics and sort of junior priests how to deal with people in their own churches and in confession and things like that as well. So they'll say, you know, if someone confesses to you that they're doing X, this is what you should say to them. And magic does come up in those quite frequently, as well as something that was a concern, not necessarily something that you had to sort of call in the Inquisition for, but a concern that would need to be dealt with on that kind of lay people level. Some of the interesting examples we have of people who practice magic in Yorkshire come from the registers of the Archbishops of York, not surprisingly. So these would be records of their visitations, any sort of cases that have been brought to them specifically and were of interest. So we do get a few mentions there as well. So that's quite an interesting source for us. If we want to find out more about what educated people thought about magic, we can always read texts on theology and natural philosophy as well, which is kind of what you would have called science at that point. And they can give us all sorts of different ideas, as I discussed with William Averne, you know, around belief and around thoughts, both sort of the positive and the negative ideas around magic at this point. We also have a few books of magic, or practical magic. Usually these are books of ritual magic, so they're to do with summoning spirits, sometimes angels, sometimes demons. They're really, really fascinating texts because a lot of them are obviously put together by practicing magicians, even if we don't know who those people were. And they can tell us a bit about practice as well, particularly on this level of ritual magic, which we'll get to, I'm sure, at another point, but so I won't go into too much detail about that. We also very, very rarely get cases of sort of personal accounts by practicing magicians. This is so rare that I can only think of one example to give you at the moment, which is a guy called John of Morigny, who was a French monk in the 14th century. And his case is absolutely fascinating because it's kind of like a diary where he talks all about his experiences working with this magical text called the Ars Notoria. And if you are interested in that, a scholar called Claire Fang has written an entire book about it, and it's absolutely fascinating stuff to look at. And I suppose the other kind of the last source that we have if we're interested in that practical side of magic is looking at the records of sort of charms, usually healing charms in most cases. These occasionally get included in medical texts and books of receipts. So we can occasionally, when we're looking through these sort of recipes for different curing herbs and medicines, we'll find sort of written charms that were spoken aloud, sometimes with the, you know, with the medicines and sometimes on their own. And that's really interesting as well, because it shows us that this is a kind of magic that was going on quite frequently and was kind of getting combined with medical practice at the time as well.
It's so interesting how the line is kind of blurred between what would have been magic and what would have been just medicine, you know, like
definitely,
like using herbs and things. Of course, that's still used today, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's a really blurry line just between religion, magic, and science, including medicine and science there. And I think sort of medical practitioners were one of the people who could kind of get away with it a little bit more, especially if they were using kind of more orthodox religious ideas behind their charms. So the charms might call on God and Jesus and Mary and some saints, for example, and it's really more like a blessing or something like that to go with the medication. Only occasionally they include sort of magical words as well. So that's where we get really interested, because that's kind of clearly a magical practice in there.
So magical words, and you've used quite a few terms. What were the different terms for people who practiced magic, and what do they mean?
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic, actually, because then, like now, there's a bunch of different words in English that we use for someone who practices magic or who has magical powers. Usually we're using these things sort of in fiction these days, but, you know, enchanter, sorcerer, necromancer, these are all words that would have been familiar then as well and would have been used in different cases. And like now, there's no real strict definition as to what they mean, and they could be used somewhat interchangeably. Although some of these words might have had, like necromancer, for example, might have had more negative connotations, and you would only use that when you were sort of putting down the practices of someone else. Obviously, a lot of the records that we discuss that we use as sources are in Latin. So we're interested in kind of the Latin words that are used as well. And there are two sets of words that have kind of come up quite frequently. And one is sortilega or sortilegus, which kind of comes down to us through the French into sorcerer. So if you think of that as sorcerer or sorceress, and that comes from a Latin word that really actually means fortune teller. But by the time we get to the Middle Ages, it's being used much more liberally to refer to all sorts of different kinds of magical practices. So you could really use sorcerer for anyone who's practicing magic, whether you're approving of it or not approving of it, but it's very clearly magic in that case. And the other one that comes down, which is quoted quite frequently because it's used in later witch trial texts and also in the Bible and certain translations of the Bible, is malefica or maleficus, which kind of means in the original Latin something like someone who does bad things, basically. But by the Middle Ages, it's being used to mean people who practice magic to harm other people. So that's a really clear distinction that we have with that one. And that's the one that later on gets used for witches, basically, and translated into witch quite frequently. So how witches used in the Middle Ages, I'm not as familiar with, to be honest with you. I think it's probably interchangeable again, but it does and has for a very long time had negative connotations, the word witch. So it tends to be used when you're referring to someone who's cursing people or blighting crops, or much like it is in the witch trials, rather than someone who's a sort of educated magician, which, as we were talking about before. And that's actually not a gendered word in the Old English either. So even though we use witch predominantly for women now, largely because the witch trials were sort of directed predominantly at women, the original sort of Old English word had a male and female form. So you could be a male witch or a female witch originally as well. So none of these forms are really gendered in the Middle Ages, although they may get sort of applied more and more to men or women later on due to things like how educated they are rather than their actual gender.
So you mentioned the witch hunts, which were a bit later than the medieval period, but were people who claimed to use magic or even openly practiced magic, were they prosecuted at all during medieval times?
Yes, but not very much. In fact, surprisingly little, I think. Most of us go in with this expectation that you're going to see all these terrible trials and things like you do in the later early modern period. But it just wasn't a priority for the clergy at that point because there were so many other things they were more concerned about. They were more concerned about heresy, for example, like the Lollards. They were more concerned about whether you were fulfilling your marital vows. There was all sorts of other cases that came up in the church courts far more frequently and that were a far bigger issue for churchmen at the time. And quite often when we do have these cases of people that are persecuted or brought to trial or discussed even in things like the Archbishop's Register, it's in conjunction with a number of other things they've done as well. So they're probably not just guilty of the one crime, if that makes sense. They might have, you know, if it's a clergyman who's being accused, he might have, you know, had relations with women, for example, which he's not allowed to do as a monk or a clergyman of particular types. They might have sort of insulted someone or stolen something or done a number of other things to basically get to the point where magic is being added to that case as a sort of final nail in the coffin of all the other bad things this person has done and you need to do something about them. So that's kind of what we tend to see the most. And there's a few high profile cases, particularly in the late Middle Ages, so sort of towards the 15th century. Basically, the only way that you're likely to have been executed for magic in the Middle Ages is if you did something negative towards the king. So if you committed treason or if you plotted against the monarch. And there's a really high profile case, which you may have heard of, with Roger Bolingbroke and a character called Marjorie Jourdain, who were both accused and sort of implicated in this treason case against the king, against Henry VI. And they were both executed. Roger Bolingbroke was supposed to have read the astrological chart that would say when the king would die. So obviously that's a treasonous act. And I think Marjorie Jourdain was more of a sort of what we would think of now as a witch, in the sense that she was procured to make various potions and concoctions and things. And they were both executed, actually. And magic was one of the reasons they were executed. But in this case, it was because they were, you know, committing treason, basically.
That's really interesting. Can you give us some examples of the type of people who practiced and studied magic?
Sure. So we've actually got some really interesting examples from York and from Yorkshire, which I'd really like to mention because they don't get as widely talked about, partially because we don't have as much information on these people that we'd like. Sometimes they're only referenced once in something like the Archbishop's Register, and we'd obviously love to know more about them. One of my favourites and one of the most interesting ones to me is a man called William Bigg. So the Register tells us that he came to Wombwell in 1465, and that for a few years he earned his livelihood by finding stolen property with a crystal. And this is fascinating because there's a lot of other magical texts and records that talk about using crystals as sort of seeing stones. And these are usually pieces of clear quartz that have sometimes been polished. And they use these stones sometimes to invoke spirits or sometimes to sort of go into a kind of trance. We're not really sure how it worked necessarily, and get the information that they wanted out of them. So in this case, it was finding stolen or lost property. And this is how he made his money. It was his profession. I think he also probably had books of magical texts that we discussed earlier. So he may have had texts that talked about summoning spirits and things as well, because these come up in his trial. Interestingly, he may have actually been linked to that more famous case, the one that the treason against Henry VI, because apparently he was in London at the time that happened and quickly kind of left, and apparently left some of his books behind there as well. So there's a very tiny possibility that there's a link there. And one historian has certainly made that connection, said, oh, that's really interesting that he then came to Yorkshire after that. So basically the way his trial went down, so he was in the church courts himself, and he was charged with heresy. So that's obviously belief that goes counter to what the church teaches, and also sort of spreading that belief or practicing outside of what the church teaches. And he was threatened with excommunication, which was the standard punishment for this at the time. And that's a really serious thing, because if you're excommunicated, you might be shunned by the rest of the community, and it could have a real serious effect on your afterlife as well, and your prospects in heaven. So instead of being charged with heresy, he actually confessed that he had been doing sorcery effectively, and he was given a much lighter punishment. And I think this punishment is really interesting, because it kind of shows the way that the church, even at the level of the Archbishop of York, was seeing magic at the time, and the way that they were treating anyone who even confessed to having done these things. And what they actually did is they made him walk in the front of a procession up and down York Minster, and he had a stick in one hand, and he had his magic books tied to the stick. And he had to have a sign basically stuck to his head that said "Ecce sortilegus," which means "Behold, a sorcerer." And then he had more pieces of paper or parchment or whatever stuck to him that said "Invocator spiritum," which means "an invoker of spirits." So he basically had to publicly announce that he'd been doing these practices. And then he also had to recant his beliefs, and at the end of all of this, burn his books as well. So it was a very public statement that I've done magic and it was a wrong thing to do. And when you think about the outcomes of that, well, obviously it's a penance for his practices, but also it's going to sort of really mean that he can't continue this business of charging people for finding their items anymore, because he's publicly had to be shamed for the practice. So I think he's absolutely fascinating for that case, and I wish we knew a little bit more about William Big. We've also got some earlier examples from the 12th century, which I think are really interesting because they involve other clergymen as well. So one is from 1280, and it's actually to do with an abbot of Selby Abbey, called Thomas of Wylie. And apparently he paid an enchanter called Elias Forvel to find the body of his dead brother in the ooze. So his brother had died. I don't know how his body got in the ooze. Maybe he drowned. I'm not sure if he'd been dumped there. And this enchanter had been paid, kind of like William Big, to just find the information about where this body was. And apparently paid quite a lot of money for it as well. And there's some speculation that it might have been church money he was spending on this as well. Now, as I was saying earlier, this wasn't the only accusation that was leveled against Thomas Wylie. There were a lot of other things that the other monks at the Abbey weren't happy with about him. So it really was just kind of the nail in the coffin for him as well. And I don't actually know, I think he was given penance and he was deposed. So he was removed from the post of being the abbot. But it was really not a serious punishment there either. And it was interesting because in this case, there's nothing to suggest that Elias Forvel was brought in front of the church courts. It was really just the man who consulted him. So you could be punished for consulting with a sorcerer as well in this sort of case. But likewise, it's a fairly small punishment in the sense that, you know, you're not going to be executed or excommunicated or anything like that. And a final one sort of from 1286, also in North Yorkshire, was a monk called Godfrey Darrell. And I just love this case because he's referred to as the runaway monk, and he's an apostate monk. So he ran away from Revo Abbey and was accused of apparently practicing nefarious, harmful spells and incantations. So he kind of set himself up, he'd run away from the Abbey and he'd set himself up as a sort of practicing sorcerer somewhere. And really the only record we have for this is that they were trying to find him. But likewise, they're trying to find him because he's an apostate and because he's doing something that's a bit scandalous, because he was a monk. You know, monks and clergymen are being held to sort of higher standard here. You know, they should be behaving, and if they're not, we need to find them and we need to make sure something's done about this, whereas we can maybe not worry about characters like Elias Forvel quite as much.
So you mentioned that a lot of these men were either religious men themselves or hired by religious men. So can you elaborate a little bit more on the link that religion and magic have?
Yeah, certainly. So there's a number of reasons that there is such a strong connection between religion and magic in the period. I read a lot about sort of educated magicians, and obviously these are going to be coming from the clergy more often, simply because they're the ones getting the education. They're the ones who can read Latin. A lot of these magical texts that we're interested in are written in Latin. So you really do need to have these skills to be able to access this information to start off with. And a lot of the sort of ritual magic and the sort of really more illicit magic, it does in some ways mimic the practices that the church are doing, even if it's sort of dealing with demons or angels or spirits instead. And so having that familiarity with these practices and having access to these materials and also the time to go through the processes that are required in ritual magic is something that really only members of the clergy are going to be able to have. So there's a kind of necessity there. That link is kind of a necessity as well. But there's all sorts of other things to do with sort of folk magic and everyday practices that tie in as well. We talked a little bit about medical magic and charms and the receipts that are being found there. So quite often those are kind of being adapted from more legitimate prayers and things. So, you know, you might have this prayer to a saint and you just change it slightly and mix in some herbs and it becomes a charm. So you can see how quite easily these things are being adapted. And also there is a kind of worldview then that's a little bit different to now, where you kind of, the world is not a mechanical thing the way we sort of see it post-Kantian world, you know, the sort of materialist world we have now. Everything is kind of spiritual anyway, and is sort of imbued with God's power, with divine power, and there's all sorts of different spirits. There's still belief in sort of angels and fairies and demons at this point. And so you're living in a world where all these powers exist, and you're kind of going to want to encourage them to behave for your own benefit, or to sort of improve your luck or your fortune, or to ward off evil spirits and to ward off bad luck. And magic is really a way of kind of taking that power into yourself and having the ability to do that, which is otherwise reserved by the church. But you're often using the same sort of skills and words and materials as the church is using to achieve that.
That's absolutely fascinating. Well, what sort of punishment were then handed down to the people who were ultimately prosecuted for using magic or for being sorcerers? You mentioned that a couple of them were a little bit lighter than you would expect.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, for most sort of everyday cases that come up in the church courts, they'd really be likely to have to recant their beliefs if they do believe in any of these sort of heretical ideas. But it's usually going to be a light penance. So that's going to be something like fasting, prayer, almsgiving, or perhaps a pilgrimage. These are the sort of punishments you're going to be given. And it's really just about correcting your thoughts and correcting your behavior, rather than treating you as some sort of outcast who's, you know, completely incurable and can't be redeemed. You know, if you've confessed and you've recanted, that's usually enough in that sense. So as I said, it's very rare for anyone to receive much harsher punishments in this time period. Towards the end of the Middle Ages, going to sort of the late 15th century, as I mentioned earlier, we do have some more serious cases where people are executed, usually in relation to a big treason trial or something like that. But also ideas at that point, we start to see a shift towards this combination of magic with heresy. Prior to that, they're kind of quite separate things. So the William Big case comes in this end of the century as well. And basically, Pope John the 22nd classified some forms of magic as heresy. And this kind of leads us towards the conflation of witchcraft, you know, and magic and heresy all into one crime, which we then see turning into the witch trials later on. But for most of the Middle Ages, that simply isn't the case. They're not seen with that level of seriousness or seen as that much of a danger to the others in the community.
Fair enough. I did like that you led that into how it escalated into the witch trials. That makes a lot of sense. I suppose that brings us to our last question then. Of course, we can't talk about medieval magic in Yorkshire without mentioning Mother Shipton. So what can you tell us about her?
I love Mother Shipton. She's absolutely fascinating. And she's a kind of Yorkshire Nostradamus, I think is probably the best way to put her. That's the reputation she had in later centuries anyway. And she was once really famous in British pop culture as well. There were pubs named after her. She was a pantomime character. Sort of everyone would have heard of her even maybe 100, 200 years ago, but she seems to be less famous these days, which is a bit sad. So supposedly she was born in 1488 and died in 1561. We don't actually know whether she was a real character or whether when she really was born or died, because the first reference we have to her is about 80 years after when she was supposed to have died in 1641. And that was in a pamphlet that was supposed to contain some of her prophecies. She was famous as a prophet. And the most famous of these prophecies relates to York, actually. So in it, basically the Cardinal Wolsey, who you might know from sort of the time period of Henry VIII, was made Archbishop of York by proxy in 1514. And she apparently predicted that he would see York but never enter it. And so Cardinal Wolsey is said to have seen York from the top of Carwood Castle, a few miles outside of York, but he was actually arrested while he was in the castle for treason, so he never made it to York. So her prophecy was said to have come true, and that's how she became a famous prophet. But obviously this was written down a long time after she died, and that's the case with all of her prophecies, unfortunately, and a lot of the sort of biographical information we have about her. Most of the material we have that gets sort of repeated everywhere is actually from a later pamphlet from 1667, written by someone called Richard Head. And in that, she's given a full backstory where apparently she was born at Knaresborough. And if you go to Knaresborough now, you can visit the cave where she was supposedly born. And sort of the whole story of her life is mapped out in that, along with a bunch of other prophecies that had already sort of been fulfilled by that point but could be predated back onto her. So we don't really know that much about the real person, but it's likely that there was someone that these sort of stories shaped themselves around, even though they were changed a lot over the centuries. And interestingly, another sort of famous prophecy of hers was the Fire of London in 1666. She was supposed to have predicted that. And it's actually mentioned in Samuel Pepys' diaries that he refers to that prophecy as having come true when the fire takes place. So you never know. She might have actually, you know, possibly had one or two prophecies that did come true.
That's absolutely amazing. Well, thank you so much. I feel like I've learned quite a lot. I think our listeners will have as well. But before we let you go, you have a book coming out very soon, don't you? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that if you can?
Yeah, so I'm really excited to be able to share that my first book for children is coming out next year in April. It's called Hedgewitch, and it's coming out from Welbeck Publishing, and it's actually the first in a 5-book series, which is going to be full of magic and fairies and witches and folklore. So if you like that sort of thing, please do keep an eye out for it. And if you'd like to keep up to date with what's happening with the book and everything else I have going on, you can follow me on Twitter at Sky, S-K-Y-E, McKenna, M-C underscore K-E-N-N-A. And the same on Instagram as well.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much. This was like I expected. It was quite a fun interview.
It was fun to me as well. Thanks for inviting me, Miranda.
Thanks so much to Sky McKenna for being our guest and to Zapsplat for the use of their sound effects. You can find all of Sky's social media in the show notes, but also check out our Instagram at YorvikViking to see the Judge's Lodging witch bottle mentioned at the top of the episode. Or better yet, come see it yourself. It's part of our Magic and Mystery exhibition on now at Barley Hall. But hurry, the exhibition closes early next year. Head over to barleyhall.co.uk to book your tickets now. And make sure to tune in next week when we open our cabinet of archaeological curiosities and learn about some of the strangest finds we've ever come across here at York Archaeology. Thanks for listening to that Jorvik Viking Thing podcast. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate and leave us a review. And if you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. It's the best way to help support your favorite Viking podcast. That Jorvik Viking Thing podcast is a production of the Jorvik Group and York Archaeological Trust. Researched by Miranda Schmiederer and Ashley Fisher. Written and produced by Ashley Fisher. Sound designed and edited by Miranda Schmiederer.